Good evening and welcome to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM. A very warm welcome to you on this evening of the 10th of October as we present Beyond Belief on this Sunday evening. Father Gerry Kenny here in the chair this evening. And tonight on our programme, I'll be chatting in a few moments to our colleague, Stephen Fletcher. And we will also have an interview with James Fennelly, who is the coordinator of the Lighthouse Project in Kilrush on this World Mental Health Day. And James will be talking us through some of the events that have been organised over the past week to coincide with this Mental Health Awareness Week, and also giving us some pointers and reflections on this important topic. We'll also be taking a look at the life of one of our most recent saints in the Catholic Church. Saint John Henry Newman was canonized by Pope Francis just 2 years ago, and yesterday we celebrated his feast in the Catholic calendar. We'll have an interview that outlines some of the key moments of Newman's life and also his thought process, which continues to influence the work and thought of the Church today. All that coming up, but first, a little music. Here is the voice of Barry Manilow and Could It Be Magic?
Let me know the wonder.
You're tuned to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM on this Sunday, the 10th of October. And that was the voice of Barry Manilow. And could it be magic? Well, I'm here sitting across from the man who makes all the magic for Beyond Belief over the past year or so, Stephen Fletcher, who helps produce our programmes. And very good to be with you and to be chatting again, Stephen.
Yeah, it's really good to be actually able to talk to each other face to face.
This has been an eventful week, I suppose. I just see on one of my news feeds an event that happened over in Rome in the Vatican with Pope Francis, but also with some 40 other religious leaders from around the world, from all the various faiths, who gathered in Rome, and they signed a petition that is going forward to plead for a concern about the environment to a special governmental conference at the end of the month.
Yeah, there's this big COP26 in Glasgow coming up, and of course it's all designed to try and influence the governments of the world to take action. We had Archbishop Welby from the Anglican Communion was there, and a full range, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't... There's over 40 religious faith leaders. And when I was looking down through the list of some of the faiths, I mean, some of them I hadn't even heard of before, obviously in other continents and that. But it's great that that voice is being heard, because the other statistic from this is that some 84% of the world's population... Mm. Actually have aligned themselves to some one of the major faiths in our world. So these religious leaders, by signing this petition, are representing some 84% of the world's population.
Wow. Yeah.
By doing that.
Yeah, well, it remains to be seen what practical steps that will result in.
Yeah. But the major cry from this is that they're saying that the future generations will never forgive us if we don't address this question. And we know from our young people that they are very concerned, because they've once again beginning to take action to try and get leaders and adults and that to become more aware of the whole ecology. And interesting is that the meeting was actually held on the 4th of October, last Monday, which is, in our calendar, is the feast of St. Francis of Assisi. Mm. And part of his writings, this beautiful canticle for creation, you know, his love of nature and of creation, and that is so important. And it just struck me as well, like, that I suppose our Bible is full of nature. Like, I mean, Jesus used nature to give his teaching in the parables and the seed and the sower and all things like that. But he was very familiar with the landscape around him and the fishing and all of that, and used all those images as the method of teaching us about God. So when we walk about, go out in our own back garden even, or go in our own environment and touch in with nature, it's so important. And that's also been emphasized in one of our interviews coming up by James Fennelly in relation to mental health awareness, that it's so important to go out and get a little bit of exercise and just tune in to the environment that's around you.
Yeah, and something you touched on was that the young people seem to understand it far better than old codgers like me. We've got the young actually leading us here, it seems, and we've really got to do something. It's a movement that's taking effect here in Ireland and in the UK, something called Eco Church, which is gathering, and that involves taking note of how we can improve our environment and the things we should be doing, and incorporating that into the liturgy of a service. And so, and that is proving very popular with the young people. So talk about getting young people back into church. It seems to be one of the ways is through this eco church. And so I think that's quite an exciting development.
Anything else happening in the calendar of your own church?
Yeah, well, we've got a 150th anniversary of St. Columba's Church coming up, and Father Kevin O'Brien is very keen to use the venue rather than just using it one day a week on a Sunday. He's keen that it should be used, and already we've got a number of organisations that are using it, mainly music organisations, using it for practice and things like that. But what he's got coming up are a series of concerts, and I'll have more details on them next time, but there'll be concerts just to mark 150th anniversary of St. Columba's Church, and it involves guitars and harps and singers, and also choirs will be singing there. And so that's something that just keep an eye on. It'll be published, and all the details are still being arranged at the moment. So just bear that in mind. 150th anniversary of St. Columba's in Bindon Street in Ennis, and it will be marked by a number of concerts, mainly traditional music, but also some choral music. And that's something that I think people will very much enjoy.
And I think people in the Ennis area are familiar with that as a sort of a concert venue. And anyway, over the years, it has been developing as that as well. And, you know, gives a great lift to people in Ennis as well to have those concerts.
Yeah, and it's good that we can start to revisit that and redo that again. And it's all about, as we keep saying, it's all about people coming together and sharing things.
And, you know, talking to a few musicians as well lately, like that's a lot of people have missed is the sense of live music once again. Yeah. You know, to have that is so important over time for people as well. Well, the other thing that's coming up in our programme tonight, Stephen, is actually a look. I've decided to do this maybe on occasions, that we look to the great heritage that we all share in Christian churches of very noble people who struggled with their faith and who professed it and did good. And one of those characters is actually John Henry Newman, whose feast day we celebrated yesterday in our calendar, the 9th of October. But it's only 2 years since he was raised to sainthood. And I have a very interesting feature on this, because Dermot Rowntree, who's an Irish Jesuit, talks about him and about his work. But he also brings what Newman was doing into the reality of where churches are today, and particularly the struggles that's happening within our own Catholic Church, where there's a little bit of polarization happening, especially in the United States, between what we might label right wing and progressive wing and things like that. Mm-hmm. And both sides, if you like, referring to Newman for their authenticity, and he does a good analysis of that. So that might be of interest to help people understand those controversies.
I'll certainly be very interested. Because, of course, Jerry, he was an Anglican at
that's
one
right.
time.
Exactly.
So, one of our own.
That's a lot of tension held, I think, in that person, that, you know, and that's the value of. Of it, you know, and I think previous Pope Benedict the 16th was really the person that wanted to move the step towards sainthood. And when he was in Birmingham in 2010 or 11, he began that process.
Mm. Very good. And of course, Bishop Finton has written a book on John.
That's right. And that's published by Veritas, if anybody wants to get more information on this character. So look, Stephen, time for us to move on with the programme, I suppose. And thank you for chatting with us again. And we look forward to maybe next week as well having a chat.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Jerry. Cheerio. But the tigers come at night.
The voice of Susan Boyle and I Dreamed a Dream from Les Miserables. You're tuned to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM on this Sunday, the 10th of October. Today actually marks World Mental Health Day. And in our next interview, I'm chatting with James Fennelly, who is the coordinator of the West Clare Mental Health Association based at the Lighthouse in Kilrush. James, you've been on our programme before and you're very welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me back, Father. It's good to be back.
So, James, this is a busy time because I know you've had a number of events in the West Clare area to highlight mental health awareness over the past week.
We have. Today is World Mental Health Day, and World Mental Health Week would have kicked off on Thursday night, the 7th. And we've built our week around the five ways to well-being. So each night and each day there was a different event themed to one of the messages from the five ways to well-being. So Thursday night the theme was give, and that's to encourage people to give their time in their community, to volunteer, and you get rewards out of that on the mental health side of things. So we had a give Facebook Live event where local people gave their time to sing and have a chat on Facebook Live. Friday night then we had the Connect event, and that was on a farm in Kilmill, and we had John Hayes, ex-Munster and Ireland rugby player, and George Graham, chairman of Awareness Head to Toe. They spoke at the event about their journey and how they look after their mental health and well-being. And the theme of the event was to connect and the importance of keeping people connected. So we had stands from the IFA, MACRA, Chagas, Embrace Farm, Social Farming, and that we're just trying to reinforce the importance of staying connected to someone during your times of isolation, or to reconnect with someone, and the importance of to maybe pick up the phone and ring someone even if you don't feel like it. Sometimes it's easier to make a call than take a call. So then on Saturday we had a Take Notice event, and we had Aina Nilava bring everyone on a guided walk through Vandeleur Woods, where Aina was going to point out the different flora and fauna that was there and to reinforce the importance of take notice of life and nature, the natural world all around you. It's always been proven as a great way of, grounding people in times of stress. Sunday then, today, we had the Be Active event. So, one of the main themes, whether it's your physical health or your mental health, is to be active to within your capabilities. So we had a dog walk on Kilkee Beach today where we encouraged people to bring their best friend, whether it was a two-legged friend or a four-legged friend, to come down to the beach and have a walk and just, again, kind of connect with people and be active. And tomorrow night we finish up our week with a web interview with Dr. Sharon Lambert. Dr. Lambert's a Clare native. She's based in UCC in the School of Psychology. And her main areas of interest and research would be dealing with marginalised and vulnerable groups and the link between early trauma and what transpires then with mental health and addiction. So looking forward to that interview tomorrow evening as well.
You've been listing out the various events and the, if you like, the labels on those events, the connect, the give, etc. They're very simple little steps, but they're very important for our well-being.
Well, they are. And look, we would, I suppose, we would always say to people, there's the very, very simple things people can do every day to look after their physical health and their mental health. And it's the same themes reoccur. You have to look after your sleep. You have to make sure you're getting enough sleep. Everyone needs to rest. You have to look after your diet as well as you can within your means, okay? Having a breakfast roll or burger and chips every day, while it might taste nice, it's probably not giving your body the nutrients you need to, you know, to get through the day-to-day things. And then a bit of exercise within your capabilities as well. You know, as we get older, you know, we all feel the growing pains. I certainly feel them in my knees and things. But, you know, I would have to tailor my exercise. But to get out for a walk and do a little bit, do something rather than sit in, especially as the winter nights draw in now, it's very easy to pull the curtains at 4 o'clock and sit inside and not do anything. But as we come out of the lockdown, it's probably more important now than ever for people to look, maybe put on the coat, put on the extra layer, the hat, the gloves, and go out even if the weather isn't the best and get that little bit of exercise in.
And I suppose as society is beginning to reconnect and get back to some form of normality as well, things like meetings and I know, like in my own work, there's, you know, things are piling up again. But the day-to-day frustrations that all of us go through, you know, is it good to have some sort of pattern of helping us to relieve that stress?
Well, we would look at the simple things would be your routine. You know, and having a good routine. And during lockdown, everyone was always told about social distancing, wearing your face mask, washing your hands. So as we come out of the lockdown and return to the new normal, there will probably be a lot of anxious people wanting to know whether they can still do these things. But you always keep in the back of your mind, you know, that COVID is probably still out there. But you can keep yourself safe and you still can go out and engage with people and meet people. But it's no harm to keep the face mask handy and wash the hands and keep a bit of distance between people. And then I suppose one of the main things I would say to people to do, you know, when they're feeling maybe things are a bit tough on the days, go outside and sit in your back garden. If you don't feel comfortable going out into the public, go out into your garden, get some fresh air and take notice of nature and the world around you.
Going back to your own particular work, James, and at the Lighthouse, over the past months during the lockdowns and all of that, you have been all obviously trying to connect and keep people informed. Can you tell us something about the services that you're now providing from the Lighthouse in Kilrush?
What we're working on at the minute now is we hope to recommence our music club in October. Adele has been very busy and Adele would have been on the farm event as well that we're doing in Kilmahill. So we hope to re-establish our music club. We're looking to go again with our poetry club, which I was part of the last time, says very enjoyable. And into November then we're going to be running a two-part workshop on resilience with Midwest Aries. Now, resilience is, I suppose, what is resilience? Resilience is how you deal, how you react to everyday knocks that life throws at you and the stresses and strains of life. So that'll be an interesting workshop that will come in November. And we would hope as we exit lockdown and when the government announced on October 22nd that we'll be able to operate 2 drop-in clinics a week into the Lighthouse where people can come for a cup of tea, a chat with one of our peers if they need be, or just not to be isolated. And we'll see how that goes. We're looking at 2 days a week starting the end of October. And that'll be a focal point for people to come up. And I say, if they want to have a chat with one of the peers, we will have peers who would have lived experience with anxiety and depression. And they might want to have a chat with them in private, or they might want to have a chat in a group. And kind of a way for people to talk about the daily struggles in life and listen to how other people will deal with it.
And how can people get in contact with you at the Lighthouse?
So they can contact us via email, which is westclaremha@mentalhealthireland.ie. Phone is 086-604-3473. And on Facebook through Messenger if they contact the Lighthouse.
James, continued good wishes for the work that you're doing. And thanks for joining us on this Mental Health Day.
Thanks very much, Father Kenny. And we'll hope to speak to you again before Christmas.
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things life has in store. We have all the time in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of the way, you'll find the cares of the world far behind us. We have all the time in the world, just for love, nothing more.
Last week on our programme, my colleague Stephen Fletcher here on Beyond Belief was dipping into music from times past. And I suppose I have been able to listen to a lot more music during the lockdowns than I had been up to recently, with a little bit of time on my hands, and discovering old tunes and newer versions of them and that. And one in particular that has always been a favourite of mine comes from the Beatles collection. It comes from the album Revolver, which I think was produced around 1963. And on that, there's some really classic songs. One of those was a Lennon McCartney composition called For No One. But I've always felt that something was missing in that particular version. And I think for my ears, it was that the tempo of the original was a little bit too fast. But then I discovered this Israeli singer, Isaac Cohen, who had done a cover version just a few years ago on an album that I think actually suits the lyrics very well. The lyrics, according to McCartney himself, were written coming out of an argument with one of his girlfriends. And it speaks very poignantly about breakup. So this evening I'd like to share this Beatles song with you, but in a newer version, For No One.
Find out all her words of kindness linger on when she's no longer with you. She wakes up, she makes up, she takes her time and doesn't think she needs to hurry. She's no longer with you, and in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. Dun da 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 di da 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 da. Stay home, she goes out. She says that long ago she knew someone, but now he's gone. She doesn't need him. Your day breaks, your mind aches. There will be times when all the things she said will fill your head. You won't forget her. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
The song For No One, sung there by Avishai Cohen. This was an original Beatles song, as I've said, and I've always liked that sudden and dramatic ending. It's always left me wondering, is there another chapter in that particular story of breakup? Two years ago, on Sunday the 13th of October 2019, Pope Francis declared John Henry Newman a saint. Newman was a great English scholar living in the 19th century. He had been declared blessed by Pope Benedict at an open-air mass in Birmingham in 2010. In our next interview, Pat Coyle chats with historian Dermot Rowntree about Newman, and particularly about the development of his thought process and his contribution to the great theological debates that still are ongoing in our churches.
Well, Newman's cause was begun quite a while ago, and it got an extra impetus during the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI because he had a long-standing devotion to Newman. In fact, he credited Newman on more than one occasion with having both helped him personally, but also given the church a sense of history as a what they call a theological locus, seeing history as being a source and a font of content worthy of theological reflection. That wasn't the tendency in Catholic theology or philosophy to incorporate the historical, the sense of things developing over time, but it had become the mainstay of Newman's own personal theology. And Pope Benedict wanted himself personally to do the beatification. So he did so during his 2010 visit to Britain in Birmingham.
Just remind people who John Henry Newman was, a potted biography. A lot of people might know the hymn Lead Kindly Light that he wrote the words to, but he's a very substantial figure in the whole Catholic tradition.
He is. His life traverses the 19th century almost perfectly. He was born in 1801, he died in 1890. So that's pretty well the whole of the period from the end of the revolutionary era to the beginning of modernity with the 20th century. He was effectively an evangelical Protestant for his earlier years, but during his 20s, when he began to take things more seriously, he moved very much towards what they call a high church Anglican position. He was very influenced by a lot of what they call the Anglican divines of the 17th and 18th century, and they themselves had a strong sense of the importance of the early church in determining what constituted legitimate Orthodox Christianity. He followed that, and it was much of his early work, much of his sermonizing was around the themes that were suggested by that tradition. But it took him to a place he never expected to go, and that was towards the idea that it was Rome rather than Canterbury that was the legitimate development of the early church. That was so incredibly countercultural in the Britain of his time. It's because not just the fact that he was such an intellectual giant, but because he showed such gigantic courage, heroism, in following through what was exceedingly difficult at a personal and relational and institutional sense.
You mean when he converted to Catholicism?
In 1845, he became a Catholic and effectively wrote himself out of the larger story that he had been very much a part of in the Anglican Church in Britain.
He has written an awful lot, as you have said. And from that, you get a sense not only of that huge intellect and that understanding of history that he had and its importance in the tradition of the church. He was also a deeply spiritual man.
He was extraordinarily spiritual. In some sense, the evangelical instinct that he had, even as a teenager, never left him right through his Catholic years. He then had this profound kind of instinctual sense that there were just two great realities that could not be denied, himself and God, or rather, God and himself. But that stays throughout as a kind of leitmotif of his entire life. When he comes to look at the development of the church, he looks at it very much in terms of a kind of a psychological development of the church as a kind of person, indeed as the person of Christ, but as a human person who grows cognitively, grows developmentally, emotionally, and every other way. It's like the church is this one great person before God, learning to become more godlike. And then when he comes later in his life to deal with the other greatest of his themes, conscience, again, we're left with this dramatically spiritualized, theological, but deeply psychological sense of one person before God being attentive to a voice that makes the difference and that tells him that there is something, there is a set of values that lies outside himself, which he cannot account for simply by looking internally.
You know, I'm reminded when you were speaking there of, first of all, let's take the whole organic nature of things developing. That was very important for him and different from an understanding maybe of a more static notion of who we are and who the church is.
Yeah, very much the dominant sort of thought pattern in the 19th century was that everything about the church was unchangeable. There was a dramatic emphasis on the transcendental, the suprahistorical, the idea of the grand, unchanging, absolute fact of God and God's things. And for Newman, this was problematic because it made no accommodation for the ordinary changes which occur in the course of church history. I mean, Newman found himself saying we must start with the church as a fact of history, and we've got to account for it, not explain it away. We have to make sense of the fact that there was no clear Christological doctrine for 300 years after Christ's death. There was no clear Trinitarian doctrine, no clear doctrine that said Father, Son and Spirit are consubstantial until nearly 400 years after Christ's death. Marian doctrines took longer still. So too did penitential traditions, the structure of the sacraments, all of these things. How do we make provision for a church that is able to change in these respects and in other respects, sometimes dramatically? How do we do so without having a kind of a theory that accommodates the historical and does not try to rest everything on the unchangeable?
Now, that's interesting, because today Newman is in the spotlight again, and not just for being made a saint, but he's been appropriated by people on both sides of what might be called the very conservative side of the Catholic Church and the more liberal side. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, it's a curious phenomenon, because we now have both people who, sadly, are often at each other's throats in the church these days. Pope Francis's conservative critics and Pope Francis's progressive defenders, I suppose. It's a little bit of a trite division, but it holds. And they're both very pleased to hear that Newman is to become a saint later on this year. Each of them will invoke the same notion in Newman in particular, that is his theory of the development of doctrine, but they have two very different takes on it. For the conservatives, Newman's understanding of the development of doctrine is that a doctrine may only develop in a way that's completely internally, organically consistent, the way an acorn may only become an oak tree. It can't do anything else. It can't turn into some other kind of creature. An infant will become a man or a woman according to its kind. And that there is this necessary progressive development that absolutely limits the manner and the direction in which the development take place. For the more progressive people, Newman's understanding of development is more ample, is more subtle and more complex than that allows. And it is true that Newman does take images of strict organic development as an explanation or as a kind of model of dogmatic development in the church. He does take instances of infants and acorns and things, largely from the early church fathers. But he adds to that, again, in keeping with what I said about him earlier, the idea of a psychological development. The infant who becomes the man or the woman doesn't just change in the length of their limbs or in their girth or other accidentals. They also change in their understanding of the world around them. They come up with simplistic understandings when they're young. The understanding deepens later. They correct older misunderstandings. They go down blind alleys. They correct themselves. They experiment with one way of looking at things. They are exposed to outside ideas. They appropriate them or assimilate them, to use Newman's word. And that has its own effect. And all of this, which may look, as Newman is very clear in his essay on development, which may look like it is wayward, may look like it is a little bit, let's say, out of control, if one looks at it closely, one could see that underlying it all, there is what he calls a preservation of type. That one could even become, and he puts this into terms of, say, British politics in the 19th century, one could be a Whiggite liberal and then toy with being a Peelite Tory, and then go back or take a third stance. But underneath it all, there's what he calls a large consistency, a continuity of value or of type. And Newman is clear that what he sees as the sources of corruption in religion is the people who stay faithful in every last detail to what they have received, but fail to move with the developments in the teachings. And this, for him, is part of his way of giving an account for why the Anglicanism that he had inherited, which had the appearance of being more faithful to the early church than Catholicism, which had added a whole set of ideas of ecclesial authority, of cult of the saints, of Mariology and all kinds of things, it would appear And it was the kind of the brave claim of the High Anglicans of Newman's time that they were the ones who lay closest to the Church of the Apostolic Fathers and of the pre-Nicene and post-Nicene Fathers, East and West. But Newman said, ah, but you failed to move with the development. And that's why Rome, for Newman, is not the church that looked most like the church immediately after the time of Christ, but it's the church which looked most like the church that came immediately after the time of Christ should look after 1800 years of development, of coming into contact with outside systems, with having internal conflict, with meeting new systems of philosophy and theology and toying with one idea after the other and having rituals emerge and then rituals disappear, all kinds of things. This messier, more unpredictable and scintillating development is what Newman has in mind.
Tell me, for you then, as a historian and as somebody very interested in matters of faith, what that means concretely today that Newman is offering, because we see Pope Francis is under fire very much from an alt-right who are very nervous and vitriolic about the changes he's brought in, say even in relation to the death penalty, and saying that he is changing church doctrine and is an almost schism or heresy.
Yeah, I won't take any of the particular instances. They're there for sure. There's the question of access to the Eucharist for divorcees, and as you say, there's capital punishment and all these other things. And when they come up, Pope Francis himself or people who are defending him will invoke the development of doctrine, Newman's idea of the development of doctrine. What tends to happen then is that the conservative critics will say, aha, you want to talk about Newman and the development of doctrine. Don't you know that Newman is all about the development of doctrine has to happen within a tight conservative frame? Now, I contest that. I think this is to misunderstand Newman entirely, and it's to impose a very different spirit, a very kind of anti-historical or at least ahistorical spirit onto what Newman is talking about. It's kind of effectively a kind of a scholastic, a Thomistic or scholastic framework is superimposed onto what Newman is doing, and it doesn't fit. I think one way of looking at what's at the tension that is evident in the church at the moment is to look at the Second Vatican Council, because this really is the watershed event. Newman is often seen as being, and in fact Pope Paul VI referred to him as being a kind of a father of the council. The difference which Newman made to the new theologians of the 20th century, Yves Congar, Henri de Lubac, Jean-Daniel Leu, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, all these the greats of the 20th century, the fact that Newman gave them this historicist approach to understanding Christian doctrine and its development, that fed into the council, and it made the council doubly attentive. One, back to its sources, the ressourcement, the return to the sources, back to scripture and the early tradition of the church, but also the second one, which came under the rubric of aggiornamento, being attentive to one's own time, to staying up to date. You're looking in two directions at once and you're holding this, a kind of a creative tension to keep these two things together. The earliest pristine spirit of the church and the concrete reality that's in front of you. The tendency, and Newman had identified this as a tendency in the Anglicans that he left behind when he joined the church in 1845, the tendency is to give foreground prioritization to antiquity. We must always refer everything back to the past. And Newman was saying this is the failure to recognize where development might bring you, the failure to respond to the concrete reality that you're facing. I happen to think that it's Francis and it's Francis's defenders who are right in their way of invoking Newman and Newman's development of doctrine. I think that Newman would very much be along the side that Francis is with regard to holding these two very different sort of frames of value together, what we have received and what we are facing. That's what brought Newman into the church, and it's very much what the Second Vatican Council was doing. But nowadays what we've had is, sadly, a great number of the conservatives in the church who were broadly in favour of the Second Vatican Council, so long as it was what they saw as being its excesses were restrained by conservative popes, now with Francis have said, oh, we should have seen it all along. The problem was the council itself. What we must do is try to get the council negatived and go back to the time before the council was there. And this is, I think, the great error of antiquarianism. This is the failure to pay due attention to the God-given concrete historical moment that one lives in.
To conclude, he spoke beautifully about change. To grow is to change, and to change often is to become perfect. Is that correct? You mentioned conscience, the importance that he put on conscience, and that would have influenced documents in the council, Dignitatis Humanae and things like that. What's your summary of this man that you've written and read about for so many years?
I think I'll go back to where I started, which is to say that canonization is about personal holiness. And Newman is the intellectual giant that I've been describing. But again, what underlies all that, and what animates all of what he did, what he said with regard to development, education too, I've left that out, but that's very important. His sense of kind of an integrated intellectual life, very important. How important it is for Catholics. His founding of the Catholic University in Ireland is one instance. Various efforts to try to get Catholics to engage with Oxford is another. Then, as you say, conscience and other matters of that kind. What animated his entering into any of these things was a profoundly selfless attention to the values that were important. Whether he found them easy to support or not, they needed to be pursued and they needed to be revered. And what I like about him, and I'm going to be a little bit perverse here, what I like about him in particular too is that he was a very sensitive man, oversensitive at times, and there's no doubt about it. You cannot read the life of Newman, you cannot see the complications in Newman's personal relations without seeing how much he smarts under the lash, a phrase he uses more than once himself, you know, of people disregarding him or people taking him up the wrong way, which they often did because he was very much more subtle than many of his detractors. But it hurt him not. But also he was hurt people talking behind his back, having his works dilated to Rome on suspicion of heresy, in one case by a bishop who later came back crawling to him, begging him to come with him as a paresis to the First Vatican Council, which he turned down. But over and over again, people, even if he tried to hold out the hand of friendship, sometimes he got his wrist slapped, and it always hurt. And I think it was a deep, deep personal sensitivity. Friendship for him was an all-important matter. And this is very different from the highly intellectual Newman we're talking about, because he took as his motto, he had the phrase cor ad cor loquitur, one heart talks to another heart. And this is what he saw his whole life is doing when he writes about the development of the church, when he writes about education, when he writes his enormous private correspondence, staggeringly large private correspondence, people writing to him with all kinds of anxieties, and he replies with such beautiful elegance to them all. When he writes about all of these things, he sees himself all the time as writing one heart to another.
The voice there of Dermot Rowntree, historian, chatting with Pat Coyle about St. John Henry Newman, whose feast day is now marked in the Catholic calendar on the 8th of October. One of the great prayers of John Henry Newman is this hymn, Lead Kindly Light.
Thank you.
Lead Kindly Light, the hymn composed by St. John Henry Newman. And that brings us close enough to the end of our programme on this Sunday evening here for Beyond Belief. We do hope that you have enjoyed our company, and I hope wherever you are that you are safe and warm on this October night. Just a reminder that on next Sunday in the morning time at 9 o'clock, we will be with you again for the celebration of Mass. And later on then, on next Sunday again at 9 o'clock in the evening, we'll be back with Beyond Belief. And next week, as we approach World Mission Day on the 24th of October, we'll have some interviews about the work of missions right throughout our world. I'll be chatting with Kilrush native Father Michael O'Sullivan about the work of missions and how we can support them in that work by our prayer and generous donations to the special collection held for Mission Sunday. So all of that has to come next week. In the meantime, I do hope that you have a very peaceful and fruitful week ahead. From all of us here in the Beyond Belief team, and my thanks especially to Stephen Fletcher for producing this programme. From all of us, we wish you a very safe week. May God's blessing be with you. Sláinte agus beannacht.